Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone and welcome to the Dealmakers Show. So today we have a really exciting founder joining us. We're going to be talking about the whole stuff of building, scaling, financing. Now, in this case, you know, for them, they're outside of the U.S., you know, really interesting how they got started first with two co-founders, then they brought another two co-founders a year in. We're going to be talking too about the journey of raising money from U.S. VCs when you're not in the U.S., and then also how to think about raising capital for a segment that is not really the typical VC backable type of segment to begin with. So again, you know, brace yourself for a very inspiring conversation. And without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Kieran Donovan. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, great to be here, Alejandro. Super excited.
So originally born and raised in Sydney, you know, father was a pilot, mother was a teacher. Give us a walk through memory lane. How was life growing up for you?
Dude, it was literally white picket fence. Grew up on a pretty suburban street, white picket fence, white house, very, very sort of traditional suburban upbringing, local school. And, you know, when I get back to my hometown, it's incredible because I just run into so many people that I went to school with because it's just that type of environment.
So you're a creative kind of guy. You know, at what point do you really, you know, feel that there is like some real creativity there going on for you?
You know, I'd always been into the creative writing bit, even as a young kid. I would just do that for fun. And I would just write and ideate and come up with all sorts of stories. And that was probably from the age of 6 or 7. And in fact, a few years ago, I actually dug out some old diaries and came across some stories that I'd written as a kid, which didn't quite hold up. But it's always been there. And it's definitely something that I embraced, particularly as I got older.
So let's talk about that. You know, as you get older, you know, you embrace that to the max. In fact, you know, you ended up packing your bags and trying your luck in New York City. So tell us about that.
I did. I finished high school and I decided that I would go to college and I would do creative writing. And my parents had sort of said, well, you can't just do creative writing. You need a real career. And so I paired it with law school at the same time. And I went through that with the intention of never being an attorney, of never being a lawyer, and only embracing the creative writing side. And so once I finished college, I went to New York and I embraced that. And I was writing, the whole experience of juggling that, writing in cafes 12 hours a day, submitting to all sorts of agents, flying back and forth between LA and New York, trying to get meetings with production companies, had a script option. So stuff sort of happened, but eventually I ran out of money. And I had to return to Sydney and call the law firm I'd interned at and say, you don't have that job by any chance, do you?
And how was it that for you? Because you either succeed or you learn. You know, it was kind of like a good exposure to what running out of money looks like. You know, I'm sure that it was not easy to make those phone calls.
It wasn't easy because I think there was a big part of me that just didn't expect that it wouldn't work out. I backed myself 100%. I didn't feel like I had a backup plan, but actually, in hindsight, looking back, I did. I always knew I had the legal career to fall back on. If it didn't work out, I could go back, I could get the job. I always knew in the back of my mind, but I pretended that that didn't exist. I pretended that it was the only option. And so it was a big move to go back to Sydney after having spent that time in the US and traveling and all that experience, and then really having to own the fact that that big plan I told everyone about didn't quite work out.
So how do you land in London?
I spent a few years working as an attorney back when data wasn't. It wasn't what it was today. And I remember when we would advise on acquisitions, the data component of a transaction was reviewing a website link. That was it. This was back in 2010, 2011. But what I was very excited by was the prospect of working on a lot of the bigger transactions that were happening around the world. And so I eventually, although I was way too junior, to do it. I put my hand up and basically called every recruiter who would take a phone call with me and say, I want to move to London. Get me a job in London. I really want to go and try it with the big league. I want to work for a big firm. I want to work on the big deals. And I kept getting told, know your place. you need more time under your belt. And I just didn't take no for an answer.
I hear you. Now, obviously, you land in London and you were working there at Latham & Watkins, one of the top law firms globally. But it sounds like you like traveling. You like to experience different places, Kieran, because that took you all the way to Hong Kong. So I guess the question that comes to mind here is, what do you think, you know, what kind of perspective it has given you to be able to have that opportunity to live in so many different places around the world?
It's such a good question. One of the things that I feel has been such an asset for me, particularly more recently, is just having the benefit of empathy with all sorts of different scenarios. And I think that comes about from having, firstly, lived a whole range of different experiences myself, including running out of money and having to swallow my pride and return home to my hometown and start all over again. In addition to all of the experiences I've had embracing other cultures and languages, I've learned bits of languages along the way. I spent a ton of time in places like Beijing and Shanghai for months at a time where I had to pick up the language in order to figure out how to get around. And so I think it lends a real unique perspective when you're living somewhere that's outside your home and you do that over and over and over again in different places, that you recognize more of the similarities than you do the differences.
So landing in Hong Kong, you know, that was quite a big deal for you because you were opening office for Latham & Watkins. I guess that this was kind of like the first experience to entrepreneurship, you know, of some sorts, not intrapreneurship, you know, perhaps, you know, how was that as an experience?
It was entrepreneurship, but with a giant safety net. And so I knew I had the benefit of a fantastic firm with plenty of fantastic people who would support me. And coming back to what we were talking about earlier, if it didn't work out, I could go back to London. And so the mission that had been set out for me moving to Hong Kong was see if you can build a practice. See if there's runway there to build something special. See if there's a market there where folks are willing to really embrace what we do with the tech and data focus and the media focus that we had. But there was the backup plan. I could go back to London if I really, really needed to. And so I knew that phone home button existed. But I didn't want to go back. And so this time around, I treated every day as though I was going to get called back to the mothership at some point. And so I needed to make it work. And this was the second time round, right? This was the second time I'd made this sort of big move. And so I couldn't quite stomach the idea of it not working out a second time. And so I was relentless. And I just embraced it every day to build a pretty formidable and really exciting practice and team.
So here you are, 13 years in as an attorney, you know, having been in Sydney, in London, now in Hong Kong. And you probably, you know, you made it to partner. So you had an amazing salary. So very comfortable. Why did you decide to put yourself in a very uncomfortable situation of being a founder?
My wife asks me the same question all the time. I eventually felt compelled to solve a problem. And it was a problem that I couldn't ignore. I had ideated with the idea of doing something for a long time. Even from my earliest time in London as an attorney, I would always have that at the back of my mind. I loved doodling on a page where I would craft ideas or think about things in a unique way as compared with perhaps what traditionally clients would be thinking of in terms of deal structures, in terms of products that they were building. And so I always knew that there was something there. There was an itch I hadn't quite scratched. And eventually, I was faced with a huge uptick in regulatory enforcement and new regulation around the world around kids and teens. And eventually, you're staring down that challenge, that problem, and you're seeing two versions of the future. One is where you do nothing, and one is where you give it give it a try. And eventually I just could not live with myself if I didn't go and try. I was hoping desperately that someone would go and do this. Someone would solve this. The kids and teens online pieces is so complex and so fraught with risk. I thought, surely someone's going to try something. Someone's going to try something in this space. And over and over and over again, I just saw people trying things that weren't working. And eventually I just felt compelled and I couldn't ignore it. And so I had to do it. I don't feel like there was a choice.
So what ended up being the business model of KID? How do you guys make money?
So the core of the business is our engine, and we call it our compliance engine. And really it's taking all of the threads of the complex regulation that exists today and distilling it into a product that makes it really easy and straightforward for any developer anywhere in the world to go to market where their audience is, and in a way that embraces that audience, particularly when it comes to younger kids or teens. And I can tell you that even basic questions like what is a child or what is an adult varies wildly around the world. And I think by about December, we'll have hit 127 jurisdictions that define what an adult or a child is in various ways. And so most of the world has its own view on how to define a kid and how to define what their experience should be online, but they don't sync up. They're very, very different. And there's a reason for that, of course, because culture and social values are different from place to place. And so you don't want to homogenize that. What you want to do is embrace that. But it's really hard when you're trying to deal with a UX where you just want one UX, you want one sign up flow for your account system, you want one set of features that you're integrating into a game or a product. And so what our engine does is it simplifies all of that and delivers all of that complexity directly into the product in a way that is totally invisible to the user.
So you got started eventually, you know, as we were talking here with KID with one co-founder, and you guys waited a year and then you brought on board two other co-founders. I mean, what's the reasoning there and how did you guys go about structuring that too?
So I'm a first-time founder. And so in my view, I had always had at the back of my head, well, at the end of the day, 50% of nothing is nothing. And so I knew going in that if I was to de-risk the overall vision, then what I needed were people who were going to work toward making that vision successful. And I wasn't going to do it myself. And even with Tim, my co-founder initially, the two of us came from very similar backgrounds. So we needed someone with a business background, someone with business acumen, particularly in the gaming industry. We needed someone who understood trust and safety really, really well. We needed a technical co-founder as well, because we didn't have one. We had a vision, but we didn't know how to execute on it. And so we knew that there were going to be key roles that we needed to fill. And it just so happened that when we met Julian, who was on the business side and had run game publishers in APAC, and Jeff, who had built out trust and safety at Google and at Meta, that we got on so well, and I could see the value that those guys would bring both personally and professionally, and the contribution they were willing to make to the vision by just jumping in with both feet, that it made total sense that the four of us would be co-founders and bring this vision to life together.
Hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard. And already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
So you're in Singapore and you had the opportunity also of experiencing New York previously. And New York, you know, obviously it's a booming when it comes to startups. So I'm wondering, why doing it in Singapore versus maybe in the US? And how has it been to the journey of building something like this, you know, in a place that is outside perhaps of the startup, you know, dreamland?
It's a happy accident, but it wasn't intentional in the sense that we did actually go to raise money out in this part of the world to begin with. It's a different risk appetite out in this part of the world. And the expectations are different. The businesses that I think funds out in this part of the world see are very, very different. They don't necessarily see really, really early stage global. There are some examples of where I think there's an exception, but I think generally what happens a lot out in this part of the world is that founders come and want to take a business model that has worked in a different part of the world and are now going to deploy it to this region. And you can often compare metrics, you can show growth, you have all these, you know, great slides that you can create around, okay, this is how it worked out in Latin America, this is how it worked out in Europe, so this is how it's going to work out for the region out here. We didn't have that. We were a blank canvas. And so we were pitching, I think, in a way that in hindsight wasn't resonating in the way that we wanted. We were getting term sheets, but not anything where we thought it would be meaningful for the company. The difference was when we went to the US, and to be honest, we did it as a bit of a Hail Mary. We got a few term sheets out in this part of the world, and we thought, you know what, why don't we pitch funds in the US? Why don't we pitch A16Z? We'll see what happens. And so we were fortunate enough that we could find that connection. And then it just happened. I mean, the appetite is different, the willingness to back an early stage founder on the back of an idea and, you know, some early good positive feedback from the market. It was just so different to the way that this particular region typically operates, although I think it's changing.
How would you define or compare, what does an investor look like in that region, right? Versus an investor, let's say, in the US? What are the key differences?
I think there's a few differences. So one is the LP makeup is typically different. So a lot of the investors out in this part of the world are the LPs, often sovereign wealth funds or big pension funds. And so I think there's a different risk appetite and different approach that brings. I do also think that there's a heavy focus in terms of verticals on fintech and historically crypto out in this part of the world. And so there is a lot of investment around that space to, I think, the detriment in some ways of other verticals that have come on in leaps and bounds. I think also it's just the vision. I often speak to founders in this part of the world where they're very focused on regional expansion. And often they've been very, very successful in one country and now they're moving internationally. And I think that's a lot of what particularly VCs see. That's a lot of the founders who are pitching them. Hey, this was a super successful business. This is how it's going. I want to expand into 5 countries or 12 countries around the region, and this is how I'm going to do it. Pitching something that's homegrown and going global outbound, I feel is more abnormal, more unusual.
There's probably now a lot of founders that are listening that are outside of the US and also wondering about how to go about fundraising from VCs in the US. What can you tell them?
So what's worked for me, and that's really the one thing I can talk to, is ultimately I got told tons of advice. There was a bunch of it that was really helpful and a lot that is probably helpful for other founders, but wasn't as relevant for me. What worked for me was being very intentional and direct about the funds that I was speaking to. And so we knew that we were going after the gaming vertical to begin with. And so we were very intentional about speaking to gaming funds. Yes, we have a vision and we're already capitalizing on some of that outside of gaming, but we didn't want to get ahead of ourselves and we didn't want to be speaking to someone who wasn't necessarily ready for the pitch that we were giving. And so we were very intentional about that. I did a ton of research around which funds at which stage. And so we were speaking to people, particularly at the early stage, that made sense for where the company was. And also looking at the backgrounds of the people that I was meeting. And so I would look at where did they work previously? Where are they at in their career? Does it look like they have a family? Because I knew that another aspect of what we were doing was very focused on kids and teens and families. And so there's a very, very big difference between speaking to someone who has a 7 or 8 year old kid and this product is directly going to affect that kid's life versus someone who, you know, the kids are already at college or beyond. And so they're looking at it through a different lens, not necessarily, you know, the wrong lens, but it's a different lens. And so I think just going in aware of those sorts of things was incredibly helpful.
So obviously the VCs, they and investors, you know, they are really investing in vision too, no? As well as employees and perhaps customers. So I guess if you were to go to sleep tonight, Kieran, and you wake up in a world where the vision of KID is fully realized, what does that world look like?
To me, it's any kid anywhere in the world can go online and they get the experience that respects them for who they are and where they are.
That's unbelievable. Now, how is it to operate in a, you know, kind of like regulated, you know, space? I mean, we're talking about kids. How has it been to build a business, you know, in this segment for you guys?
It's definitely an area where a lot of concern exists from the market generally. So if you're building online experiences historically, and it's kind of, you know, if you think about it now, how many times do you go online and you get asked to enter your date of birth or to click, I confirm I'm over 13. And we all know what kids are doing at that point. You know, I've got two boys. I know exactly what's going on. And the research shows, and this is what's really interesting, is that most kids, when they click through that or when they lie about their age to sign up to a service, most of them are doing it with a parent helping them and with full knowledge of what's happening. And the parent hopes, as I do, that your kid is going to tell you if something's going on, if something's gone wrong, if strange messages are coming in. And your only choice is to hope, because there are no parental tools in those experiences. There is no age adaptive experience. It doesn't restrict certain features. It doesn't adjust things in a way that are more appropriate for that particular age band, because they're not meant to be there. And so that I think is the scary component of the internet today, is that most of the internet has forgotten that kids use a lot of the internet. And that to me is the space that is where we can be disruptive, but in a really positive way. And in a way that just makes sense. Because it's kind of wild that the first thing kids learn to do online is to lie. Like that just doesn't feel right.
At what point do you guys realize we're into something here?
It was definitely an existential crisis that we would cycle through a lot during the first, I would say, 18 months. There are key moments that are very, very meaningful. And this is probably true of any founder, but definitely for us. One was the very first time that we signed a contract where someone is willing to pay us money for the product we've built. The second one is where you consistently hear the same message. And so I love pitching. It's one of the things I spend a lot of my time doing. And when you hear things, reactions like, oh, this just makes sense. Oh, how come no one's done this? And you hear that over and over again. It really is inspiring, because that's the sort of fuel that will keep you going when you're grinding those 20-hour days and, you know, things are not coming together as fast as you'd like. I think those are the sorts of things you hang your hat on. The other thing is seeing things go live. There is absolutely nothing. Like, I can tell you that we had a town hall, the very, very first title that went live, the very first game that went live. And our CTO jumps on and there's 40 odd people on this call. And he says, everyone, just wait. Shares his screen. And there's this little dot that like pops up on the screen to show that there's traffic. And I can't, you know, for 60 seconds, we're all speechless because it's real, right? It's real. And I think that to me is the exciting part, is seeing all this vision come to life.
That's incredible. Now imagine I put you into a time machine, Kieran, and I bring you back in time, you know, maybe to that point where you guys were thinking about doing something together, maybe like around, you know, September 2023 or so. And let's say I was able to give you the opportunity of having a chat with that younger Kieran. What would be that one piece of advice that you would tell your younger self there?
Follow your gut. Just trust your instincts, back yourself, and be willing to embrace discomfort. That is without a doubt the thing that there are lots of things that I feel very uncomfortable about in terms of, you know, I'd never pitched VCs before. I was sat there in a room with huge VCs with huge, you know, ability to deploy huge amounts of capital. I quit my job. So I was all in, there was no going back. There was a lot of that. And so just backing yourself. And I would say to him, just have faith that you are on the right path and it's going to work out.
For the people that are listening, Kieran, that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
Yeah, I mean, our website is the easiest way to get in touch with the company, k-id.com. LinkedIn is where I hang out most of the time. So you can search me up, Kieran Donovan, on LinkedIn as well, under KID. And otherwise, always happy to field emails. So Kieran@k-id.com. Very happy to chat, always willing to give people time and just chat about my experience.
Amazing. Well, hey, Kieran, thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show today. It has been an absolute honor to have you with us.
Thank you so much, Alejandro. This was fantastic.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening, and see you at the next episode.